I'm Gary Knoll, and this is a continuation of our special series of examining global warming and larger environmental issues. But there is a question that has not been addressed by anyone that I've seen thus far in the mainstream or even the countercultural media, and that is the issues for why we deny climate change threats even if we believe in global warming. Let me give you a little background before we go to Oslo, Norway, for my guest who's standing by, a professor there who is trained in clinical and organizational psychology. He is also a green economist, now directing the Center for Climate Strategy at the Norwegian Business School in Oslo, where he teaches environmental economics and green growth. He is also a scholar in philosophy and mythology. He also founded clean energy companies and has been an international advisor in organizational management on four continents and on scenario planning, a strategic model for forecasting future scenarios that inform organizational planning and projects. And he has degrees from the University of Oslo in studying analytical psychology at the C.G. Jung Institute in Zurich, Switzerland. And he's the author of many academic papers and books on the psychology of money. His last book is What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming, Towards a New Psychology of Climate Action. He is also the co-author with climate futurist Randers, one of the authors of the seminal Limits of Growth study back in the 1970s, who we had on this program some time ago. And his website is stoknes.no, and he is Dr. Per Espen Stoknes. But nice to have you with us, sir.
Great joining your program, Gary.
I'd like to give a larger overview of what I see the problem as being with different tenets, and then if you would please address any that you feel comfortable with, all right?
Yeah.
For those of us who have been involved in the environmental movement, and specifically in climate change, there's many other parts of the environmental movement, including sustainable agriculture, the Rudolf Steiner biodiversity agriculture, the no-till planting, the acidification of water like acid rain. So there's at least 30 different elements involving environmental science. Only one of those is global warming, and yet today we focus almost all of our energy because it's one that we cannot escape as consequences. So on the one hand, for the larger picture, we have thousands of scientists involved in environmental research who say, yes, global warming is real. Yes, it's substantially contributed by human activity, industrial revolution, our growth. And today, especially in the United States, China, India, three of the most populous countries in the world, or at least two of the most populous countries in the world, India and China, about 1.3 billion each, the United States at 330 million. But we consume more energy. We have a greater carbon footprint. We create more global warming than any other nation, though China's close behind us. And the problem is that we're aware of this. It's not as if this is a secret. Americans are only 4% of the world population, and yet we're 26% of its total energy consumption. Now, where I differ from many of the other people who I deeply respect, and I am in complete alignment with them when we suggest let's do a Marshall Plan where the entire world, every country, joins together, bringing the best and brightest with the most salient ideas of how we can address global warming, whatever the resources, we provide those, much like we did going into World War I in 1941, where we had a war economy, and then afterwards where we helped the countries with the Marshall Plan, Italy, Germany, and France and Japan, who were affected by the war. Here's the problem I have. And this is where it deals in both not just psychology, which is the end stage of human behavior or how it's applied, but more importantly, spirituality. And you are one of the very few people who I believe have the deeper spiritual insights, based upon what I've read of your work, to address this issue. And this is not being touched upon. And if this is not touched upon, I don't believe that anything fundamental will get done. Individual countries will do what they can. Individual groups will do what they can. There'll be clarion calls by individual environmental groups and activists, but there'll be no major effort. And here's why. Most people are divided within roughly the dynamic leaders. These are the opinion leaders and the policy makers. They rise to the top and they control paradigms, institutions, countries, policies. Then you have your opinion leaders. These are frequently very charismatic people. They are convincing, they're charming, and they represent the voice for the voiceless, or at least those who perceive themselves as not having an advocate. So they're the advocate. More often than not, however, they're their own advocate, and they're very self-serving. A Rush Limbaugh, a Sean Hannity, a Bill O'Reilly, and people on the left as well, who really want you to believe that they're one of us, but they're not. They have their own agenda. But then you have, supporting these two groups, a huge professional class. In this professional class are your entrepreneurs, your business class, your academics, professors, architects, engineers, lawyers, doctors, physicians, teachers. People have an advanced education. People are fully aware of how things function. They're not functionally illiterate on any level. They're simply intentionally ignorant on some levels. What they don't want to know, they won't discover. But you give them a good argument, they can understand it. They may be in denial of the reality of it, but they're fully cogent. There are 71 million of those people in the United States. Now, they have families. And these are people that went to school, worked hard, sacrificed. And they believe that they deserve credit for their successes. And as a careerist for the last 40 years, we have been led to believe in the United States since the mid-1970s that it's a me-only world. I'm in it for myself. At some point, if I can help other people, fine, but it's my life, my responsibility. No one's going to pay my mortgage or my kids' education, so I'm going to do it for myself. And these people go up that ladder of success, whatever that ladder actually is. I don't believe there is any such thing as a ladder of success, but metaphorically, we like to believe in such things. And then one day we realize that we have succeeded, because most professional people succeed, and every human being on earth masters something, frequently more than some things. If you're poor and you're living on the streets, you've mastered how to survive on the street. The average person who's never been on the streets would not know how to survive. So even those who we consider not applicable by most social standards still succeed at something. The trouble is, when we succeed, what we succeed at becomes more essential than the other parts of our lives. Then if you ask someone to define their life, they would define their career, their successes, their achievements, and what they've gained. But that's not who they are. They've avoided, maybe they don't intentionally avoid, but they like to believe that whatever they've done, that's who they are, and that there's no separate being. So careers tend to be almost always focused upon their career. And today, I don't care where they go on vacation, or they go on a trip, or they go for a walk in the park, they're connected to their career. They're connected to their social media. And it looks like nothing they have is ever going to make them feel comfortable about themselves. There's never enough to be enough in their own life. There has to be that magic ring that they still have to have. Now, their children see this. They absorb this. They absorb this highly competitive, intense lifestyle of abundance. Their partners do the same, and sometimes their partners are professional also. So you have two careers. We talk about a prescription for confusion. Have two career parents and see what that does to the children. I can promise you the majority are going to be diagnosed with ADT and dissociated conditions and be on different medications. And no, at no time will there be an irony. Maybe we're not giving unconditional time and love to our children. We're giving them everything we thought they need and money could buy. So when I look at how much debt the professional class has, and they're up to their eyeballs in debt, as much as they're making, that's how much they're spending. But they have the lifestyle, and they thrive through this highly pretentious illusion that, look at what I have, aren't I something to be respected and deferred to? Then you have their children who are so spoiled today that the majority, not all, but the majority feel that if they're ever confronted with any issue that they can't handle, then somehow you're wrong for bringing this into their life, because they've lived in this comfort bubble, this entitlement bubble, this I deserve bubble. And so there's no standards to which they can be held accountable for their own achievements and their own insights. They're merely an extension of the social collected norms. Now, I give you this as extended background for one reason. These are the very people that we're expecting to make all the decisions, the policymakers, the opinion leaders, the technocrats, and those who control the input to the leaders to tell them what to do, how to do it, when to do it, and to get started and not to put the brakes on, full throttle ahead. And I don't see any of these people willing to commit themselves to this at all. Instead, I see these people spending so much time absolutely enamored by the lifestyle they have, the debt that they're accumulating, that every single day is paying tribute to their uniqueness of being. So where exactly are these people supposed to fit when it comes to saying, let's do it, let's get a hold of global warming, let's be responsible for the people around the world who don't have what we have, let's be considered for the species that are going extinct, 222 species every day, let's be considered for the people in Yemen and Iraq and Afghanistan that have been that are the consequences of our political and ideological overreach and imperialism and hegemony. I don't see any of that. I don't see anybody shedding a tear for the poor and the homeless anywhere in the world, or those who have been made sacrificial lambs to a regime change. I don't see anybody giving a damn about anyone else except themselves. I didn't see a single person in Congress, not the president, not the members of Congress, saying, let's have an executive order, let's have a law preventing banks from foreclosing on 7 million homes and 22 to 28 million Americans being made homeless with no help, and yet we're going to help every bank and every big corporation. I didn't see a single home being saved. Now then, that's that class, the ruling class, and it's not 1%. We've got to get over this moronic notion of 1%. That is beyond stupid. It's over 181 million people are the ruling class, or impact what happens in America. But then we have the average person, and the average person is neither dynamic, nor are they highly educated, but they're not stupid. They have an abundance of common sense. They're the worker bees of society. But think of this. Think of how many of them are now sick with diseases they could have prevented. Their children have adult diabetes and obesity. They are spending money they don't have, using credit cards that they can't pay the interest on for stuff that is absolutely unnecessary, and they can't handle the stress. And these are not multitaskers. So which of those people who could not take care of their own family, could not care for their own children, themselves, how are they supposed to be coming forward to take care of the world that they're disconnected to and don't know the awareness of? So I see, when I wrote my new article, along with Richard Gale, called Global Warming, We're Screwed, it wasn't meant as a dire prediction. It was meant as simply a pragmatic, honest look at the fact that this is what happens when an entire society, exceptions noted, disconnect from the spiritual and emotional consequences of their choices? That's my question to you then. Take your time, all you need to answer it.
Thanks, Gary. That was a powerful introduction. I think you gave embodied, well-spoken kind of outrage at the destructive type of egotism that's come to define normality in our Western societies. I'm now speaking from a more eco-philosophical point of view, responding to your portrayal. So to sum up what I heard you say, and then I'll come back to your question of how we approach this problem. What you described is the 71 million of the professional class holding and embodying the culture of Western modernity belief systems. These belief systems has certain basic cultural assumptions. And I think you touched on some core of them, like individualism, which is the idea that each human is a separate individual. There's one human, one vote. There's one human, my ownership rights. It's the individual who defines the one will and the one unit of calculation. It's also based on a certain view of rationality and rationalism, which is that a certain, so we say, narrow version of rational becomes the rational way of being. This is also founded, thirdly, on anthropocentrism, which is the idea that humanity and humans are the measure of all things and resources are here for humans. And then you touched upon also this issue of winning. If there are lots of individual, they often compete for the same resources, and everybody has to be responsible for their own winning, which is a version of heroism, setting up competition between these individuals. So if we have a mix of cultural belief systems consisting of individualism, rationalism, anthropocentrism, and heroism, all based on this entitle us to have and take all what we need and want, and this is who we are, then I think your portrayal is very correct in terms of we have a serious trouble with dealing with climate change, because it undermines and even problematizes all of these four core cultural assumptions. Now, this, of course, could look like the impossible. So if anybody concludes that, do we require everything of this to change? Well, it won't change, so then we're screwed. I think you said it. So there are lots of good reasons, even philosophical, but also cultural, for why this is going the wrong way and why it seems impossible to change. But in this, climate change comes along anyway. Global warming is, as such, saying, as if the air itself, it's saying to us, look, guys, the way you think is not in line with the way that the air and this earth works, because no one is an island. No, the what you call logic rationality is just one way of thinking among many. And anthropocentrism, the idea that humans is the center of all, is way far out from any ecosystem understanding. And heroism is a very limited way of understanding coexistence and long-term mutual benefits. So it is as if climate change, this invisible, encroaching, ghostly thing, which is not there, we can't see it, yet it's there and threatening us, is putting a major, big question mark up against all these basic assumptions that we haven't properly scrutinized yet. So in this way, I prefer to see that when the air itself is changing its ways, is bringing us a mirror screen and forcing human cultures, particularly the Western modernity versions of it, to rethink who we are. This is part of the reason why when I wrote the book, What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming, I divided it into three main parts. The first part sums up the psychological responses to news about the climate system, and hence it's about how we think when we hear and learn climate facts, and particularly by the way they are communicated through the news. The second part is an invitation to take up action, but in a way that creates engagement and thus goes with the human body and the human brain. So what does a brain-friendly climate communication look like if the goal is to engage people? And if we switch from just rational criticism to doing things together, finding opportunities for better lives, more focused on health, interaction, and a sense of common purpose, then we could activate other parts of the human being, which is not stuck just in this individualism, rationalism, anthropocentrism, etc. And then, as you pointed out clearly in the beginning, I think climate is a spiritual challenge. And in many senses, because, the very word spirit comes from the Latin spiritus, meaning breath or the moving air. So wind, a movement of the air, is both connected to the spirit and also the Latin and the Greek word for the soul, which is based on Latin anima, being animated and being enthusiastic. It's also this inflow of breath and soul into our being. So that's why I spent the last 100 pages on reorienting the climate discussion towards relating to the air itself, discovering how we are coexisting in the air, how we are interconnected with the air, and that we are always already inside the air, even when we speak about it. So this idea that we can have climate as something far away from us, as a technical thing that is subject to our instruments and our technologies, is very limited. Our bodily sense of the air and the way the air opens up our being and our interconnectedness with the plants, just and the oxygen and the ocean and the algae, everything is really there if we start our engagement with this, with connecting with the air and our breathing, first of all. That brings it to a personal level. That brings it to a spiritual level. It brings us to who we are, really, earthlings inside this air together. And in this way, I think the climate crisis is also a cultural crisis that can call forwards a reorientation towards a less, shall we say, destructive belief system than the one we've had right now. So I don't know if you agree with me, Gary, but in this way, I think the climate crisis represents a huge cultural opportunity. because if we don't change, it will only get worse.
I would agree with that. I think that's just reasonable. I believe that in my field of health, I've seen people only choose health, and reluctantly so, when they are faced with a life-altering decision. Not change and die, change and possibly live. Even then, at least 90% of people resist the change or only make the change till they get well. And I would apply that to the same principle, because you're not dealing with two sets of people, one that are sick and then they get well, and people who are disconcerned about the environment and then become concerned about the environment. We're still dealing with an underlying systemic fault line within human nature. If you really care about life, you care about all life. If you love yourself and you love life, you love all things, unless something proves that it's not lovable or a person. That means that they have disconnected from what was lovable at one point in a more innocent part of their development. So I'll give you an example of this, and I'd like for you to respond. There was a man who was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer, and he was going into hospice care. His physicians had done everything possible. He had had the surgery and the radiation chemotherapy, came back, and now there was nothing more to do, and he was very frail. And so at that point, a member of his family called, said, could you try to help him? I said, oh, sure, I'll try to help anyone. And I had a conversation with him, and the first question I asked was not about his disease. I never in my entire career have asked anyone about their disease, because that's really of secondary importance. Instead, I asked him, what is the meaning of your life? And do you believe you still have something worth living for? And if you could live your life over, would you have made changes? And he said, well, what's that have to do with my cancer? I said, it has everything to do with your cancer, because would you consider yourself a relatively reasonable and rational person? He said, yes, I am. Did you succeed at your career? He said, yes, I was very successful in my career. I said, well, if someone asked you to do something that you knew or should have known was destructive, would you have done it? He says, no. I said, but you smoked. Yeah. And you drank. Yeah. And you had a terrible diet. Yeah. And you didn't deal with stress in an appropriate manner. You were always in rage, according to your family. They only knew you to be quiet or angry. Yeah. So would you say that any of those unreasonable choices contributed to your cancer? And he said, well, I have never thought of that. I said, well, why don't you think about that? And then if you feel that you still have something worth living for, come back and see me. If not, then go into hospice care. About a week later, he came back to see me, and from then he came to a retreat. This is a year and a half, 2 years ago. And at the retreat, we put him into some classes where the whole focus was not talking about your past, but talking about if you were an architect creating your future and you had no no's, only yes's, everything was a yes, what would you create? And he was on a strict diet and juicing and cleansing and detoxing and meditation. And he felt really good when he came back. And he went back to his oncologist. Instead of being dead, his cancer was shrinking. And over the next 9 months, his cancer shrank down to almost nothing. And he was very excited by that. And then his son called and said that, you know, he went right back to the same old habits. So I called him and I said, you saw the benefit of making psychological and spiritual change. But there's no point in life to where we're healthy or spiritual or happy. We're a process. It's not a noun, it's a verb. You don't have cancer, that's a noun. You're cancering. You're not happy, you're happying. I said, so what caused you to go from a noun to a verb? And he said, well, he said, I wanted my comfort foods back, and I wanted to, you know, I've actually felt comfortable while I was doing things when other people were there and I was being guided, but on my own, when I went home, I just felt sad. I felt depressed. And I went right back to the old habits. I give you that as an example, simply to show that that's what I've dealt with for my entire career. So if we're dealing with that kind of mindset, when people's only option is death, imagine then the challenge when people consider themselves healthy and capable of making any choice, and if they choose not to make the spiritual or the moral or the ethical or the more integrative, positive choices.
That's wonderful. I like your approach there. And that, so maybe we could imagine then our destruction of the climate as a kind of collective cancer in this case, based on our old habits of fossil energy dependence and the convenience that come with them. And then finding ways to relate to this symptom by reframing it and restoring it, so we get a new sense of direction and purpose, both as individuals but also as collectives. Part of this, many feel helpless when it comes to global warming because it's such a huge planet scale problem. But then it's also, of course, a function of the individualism. So we think that I can't do it. I can't do it, fix it by myself. So it's outside my scope of influence. And thus the sense of self-efficacy is low. And we can't find a sense of shared or collective efficacy. What your patient also discovered was that when he was part of a community where there was juicing and there was meditation and there was focus on purpose, he would find strength in that community and be able to keep his old habits in check. But when he went back home, where the walls, so to speak, are full of individualism, and then his new habits or his new behaviors failed. It was easier to go back to his comfort foods, etc. It was easier to slip back into self-focus. So building on this, I think we need to restore climate change along this into a more, shall we say, healthy mode of being in the world. And in my research, I try to look at these new narratives, those who are engaged, those who change, those who work to spread the change. What story is it that is driving them or that giving them nourishment or a sense of belonging with a larger community? And interviewing people and reflecting over the way this is storied in politics and literature and news, I came up with our four archetypal stories that seem to generate enthusiasm rather than apathy. Now, this addresses different parts and different segments of the population, and some are common. But let me start with the first one, and that is creating a sense of a healthy economy. It's creating products, agriculture that is regenerative, mobility that is zero emissions, buildings that are net positive. This idea that we can make things well in terms of both covering human needs but also well for the environment is one story that is generating enthusiasm within sustainable business, sustainable finance, sustainable mobility, etc. So I really believe that this idea of green economics, a regenerative economics, circular economy, it has many names, is very important. And it's a story that gives a sense of direction of where we need to change. Then other segments of the population aren't really into economics and business and products, but they are more oriented towards being and the quality of life. So this whole idea that we need to increase our consumption, our shall we say, incomes, move up on the material status level is very old-fashioned to them, so they're looking into the quality of life. Maybe we should reorient our society, exchanging GDP with quality of life as the overarching metric and the goal of society. So what we need is people who are happy or who have experience of meaning to their lives, and that's what we should focus on as a society and as a community. Now, some that makes, and I would say the low has, the which is called the lifestyle of health and sustainability is part of that. Now, a third group of people is more into religion and spiritually oriented, and also ethics. And to those, many of them found inspiration in the encyclical that the Pope came out with last year, which called Laudato Si, which speaks about the greening of religion, the shift from being as humanity being someone who is dominating nature to being in the stewardship of nature. So we become stewards of this sacred creation, whether you call it ecosystems or Eden or just nature, doesn't really matter. And also people who are into philosophical ethics are focused on who will speak for those who have no voice. It might be other species, it might be the unborn generations, the seventh generation, etc. So bringing the sense of spiritual connectedness and responsibility for nature into the discourse is also hugely important, and many people find community around that narrative. The fourth narrative, in addition to the green economics, the quality of life focus, or the stewardship of nature in a religious or ethical frame, is what I like to call, think about as rewilding. And it springs from a deep sense of biophilia, the love of life, as the biologist Wilson named it. We really love seeing the beauty in nature. We really love seeing fish in the stream, squirrels in the trees, and maybe hear the voice of a mountain lion or a wolf, or seeing large herds of deer grazing. It brings a sense that if we could just be sensitive to nature, it will spring back. If we give it room, it revitalizes itself. And cities and its surroundings can join forces in creating the maximum of biodiversity, both in the surroundings and in the city. So this story of rewilding, stopping to work against nature and working with the flow instead, is also one of these deep narratives that can give people a sense of community and direction. And that's the key, I think, because if we feel completely on our own, that I have to stop flying, I have to cut down on my car driving, I have to flip and give up beef or meat eating, it will easily feel as a sacrifice, and it feels as a constraint, and I will easily fall prey to my other more greedy instincts. However, if we co-create, participate, and share these stories, and start find meaning from living in them, we will find a sense of community and a sense of shared direction that I think will give us a much deeper motivation as we work, and we must work hard for the reinventing this culture into something that is capable of coexisting with nature, being sustainable in the coming decades.
Here, that was very, very insightful, and I appreciate you sharing that with us. I'd like for you to address this issue, please. In the current issue of Counterpunch, there's an article entitled "The Anarchist Uprising Against the Liberal Ego" by Kim C. Domenico. I'll just quote the first paragraph. "Those who are against fascism without being against capitalism, who lament over the barbarism that comes out of fascism, are like those who wish to eat the veal without slaughtering the calf. They are not against property relations, which engender barbarism. They are only against the barbarism itself. And when I look at those who are in power at the state level, the local level, the federal level, I see an elite group of people who use their power and their ego to maintain their power and rarely, if ever, acknowledge they are wrong in what they're doing. And I don't see them challenging capitalism in order to help correct global warming. I don't see them asking for us to change our lifestyles fundamentally because they're tied into the gross domestic product. That as long as the gross domestic product is increasing and society is buying things and society is being serviced by new IT technologies or robotic technologies or visa, foreign visitor visa from educating people from India and other countries, displacing our own more advanced citizens in, who've gained seniority, they see that as important. So they want to have everything we currently have existing. They want to have a capitalist system. They want laissez-faire. They don't want the government to participate. They want citizens to have the right to do whatever they want, to make as much money as they want. And at the same time, they will tell you without any irony, and I believe that we should address the environment. So which part of the environment are you willing to address? 18% of all global warming comes from methane from the production of livestock. There are over 60 billion creatures that are raised just to slaughter. Now, at the other end of that, and according to what was just said, that that there are people who would love, like the liberal class, who would love to eat veal, but without slaughtering the calf, or not being aware that the calf suffered, or not being aware there was even a calf suffering taken from his mother so they could have the veal. They simply want the veal. They want everything separate. And hence this leads to the identity politics. So now what you have is you have all these sentient creatures being raised, but they're not raised in someone's backyard. They're not raised, you know, in the middle of Central Park. They're raised far away where people don't see the anguish of the sentient beings suffering. They don't see the pollution to the environment. They don't see these gigantic cesspools from the pork farms down in North Carolina or the chicken farms in Delaware. They don't see any of this. All they see is the steak on their plate or the chicken or whatever it is. But if you ask them, why don't we start eating your dogs and cats? They'd say, well, my God, that's barbaric. Well, why is it more barbaric than eating a lamb, a goat, fish? All of these have feelings. All these have consciousness. And so that shows you the cognitive disconnect where we're able to compartmentalize our rationalities. We're able to separate and segregate what defines a moral compass where we should have some form of feeling and empathy versus complete disconnect. Like, were they the enemy? They're my food. They're not to be subjected to any sentiment. Or they're the enemy. They're the people of Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria or Lebanon. So if the children die, we're not to have any feeling. So if you have a society so capable of disconnecting itself, and yet it considers itself a liberal, moral, and ethical society, you have to at some point address that, or we're not going to make the changes we need to make. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah. What you describe is, and I thank you first for giving voice to those pigs that are in that farm, and the chickens that are in those enclosures, and the suffering that is finding place there, which is unspeakable. And that's an appropriate word, maybe unspeakable, because when you try to bring a voice to that, you get the exact kind of reactions that you just mentioned, that it's gross to speak about eating the cat, but eating the chicken is fine. Now, this is the original meaning of the word denial as it comes from psychoanalysis. It is that you both know something and then you compartmentalize that or repress that knowledge and live onwards as if you don't know what you do know, which leads to a kind of state of double life where you know something, but then you live as if you don't know. And the same mechanisms here, psychological mechanisms, are what we see when it comes to climate as when it comes to the meat we eat. And that is also, of course, related to each other, through climate emissions. As you said, 18% is based from the raising of livestock. Now, the system that keeps this together is, as you said, capitalism. And my next book, what I'm currently writing on, is kind of rethinking economics and rethinking capitalism as itself. Because like in the quote you gave to me, that those who are against capitalism without fascism is like having the veal, wanting the veal without the cough, is implicitly saying that there's only one type of capitalism. And I think that's an oversimplification. And I think it's, again, one of these conceptual dichotomies that is stifling thought. So my question now is more also to oppose people like Naomi Klein, who says it's capitalism or the climate, by looking at different forms of capitalism. Because, for instance, the Nordic version of capitalism is quite different from, let's say, Brazilian capitalism or U.S. capitalism, not to speak about even Chinese capitalism. And also, I think the capitalism we have seen only is very destructive because it only recognizes one type of capital, which is usually the financial capital. So, well, if we could go back to the root of capital itself, capita means actually head, and it is comes from the head of your herd. So a capitalist was somebody with a big cow herd or another type of herd because there were many heads. But actually that means also that your capital is nature-based, it's not money-based. And this idea that we might start to diversify and nuance capitalism so we grow values, not just of financial type, but also of natural type and the social type. So having a value creation system that balances financial capital with natural capital and social capitals, and preferably in the plural, is a very possible way forwards. But what you also mentioned, this laissez-faire attitude that government should have no role in this and GDP is the only metric that really matters, goes against this, of course. We do need government into this and we do need to supplement the GDP with a metric that helps us see and visualize how the natural capital is changing, and the same way with the trust in society, which is core to the social capital. I think we need to rethink economics, and I think it will be rethought, as it is lots of people engaging in this now, that so that when we come to 2050, we will look back at this period, the period between 2000 or maybe 1980 and 2020, as the kind of medieval type of economy that almost destroyed itself because of its narrow-sighted tunnel view on financial capital alone. One metric I've been looking into is something called integrated wealth indicator, which looks at how we balance these things. So if we do use natural capital, do we translate it into social capital? Do we convert it into financial capital in a way that is balanced? Or if it's unbalanced, then we're probably sowing over the branch we're sitting on. And that's what, of course, we have been doing over the last 20, 40 years. And I'm giving all my time and all my efforts into redefining and expanding the concept of capitals and value itself through this contributing rethinking economics. I think that's where we really need to go to find another direction for the coming decades.
That's very, very important. I want to go into the final segment here by examining what you see would be a blueprint for addressing issues, but at what level must we also involve people working together so that there's not this sense of isolation or loneliness or apathy? What can I do? I'm only one person. Mm-hmm. When if people knew that there was a support system to help them, they're far more likely to be focused upon making that change. If someone said, let's do a demonstration, but you're the only person that's going to be there marching, it's not going to, you know, you're not going to do it. So why don't we take a look at the positive suggestions and what it means from a psychological point of view that we have to do?
Good. One of the new approaches that I've been exploring and researching and writing about is the activation of social norms. That a norm is something I believe that others would do in the same situation, and particularly those people whom I admire or I would like to be like. What would they do in this situation? And if I believe that my neighbor would want to put up a solar panel, if I believe that my former neighbor will go or has already gone low tail, I will do so as well. And if my brother gets an electric car, I might get one too. Or if the sports star I am following or admiring is going on to a vegan diet, maybe I will too. And this spreading of social norms by making it visible to others through signals, through symbolic actions, is something that we actually know works. That's, I think, adding into the support system for change that you are mentioning. And this, in a way, helps bridge ourselves out from the individualism and the isolation that we often get stuck in. So how can we then also use maybe new technology, social media and organizations to give feedback to ourselves as to the progress we're making? This is the strategy I often call for signals, so making it climate social, but also creating new signals. So we get a feedback when we do something. So if you, Gary, have gone, let's say, vegan for a week, you get a feedback on from maybe a system that tells how much CO2 and how much human or animal life or have you improved by doing so. And I've been collaborating, for instance, with people making an app called Ducky, which actually where you can log your own actions, and then your friends and your community logs actions as well. And then you can get to see what we've been doing together. So all people living in Oslo, for instance, how much have we, if we've been biking the last month, how many tons of CO2 have we avoided? And maybe even how much health have we been spreading by getting more physically active? The reason why I'm pointing this out is that the use of societal feedback, you visualize the reduction in fossil fuel cars, you visualize the improvement in value creation relative to CO2, is that the climate science have been overusing global climate system signals. I'm speaking about concepts like PPMs of CO2 in the atmosphere, or global average surface temperature change per century, or even ocean sea level rise in inches per decade. And these signals, these numbers, are utterly abstract and incomprehensible to individual, and it's hard to relate to. But if I get a feedback, you know, that my company has now turned around towards a sustainable rate of change, if our city is doing this together, if my team is doing this together, and we get some kind of weekly update, it's a basic psychology that when you get this kind of feedback, you get more motivated. There is no learning. There is no, soliding of new habits if you don't get some kind of response from others an app, a visualization that helps you confirm that, yes, this week or this today, you actually took that little step. And that's been a major drawback in the climate change strategies that have been applied so far, only using climate system indicators rather than social response indicators on a variety of levels.
Makes a great deal of sense. We're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us today. I appreciate it, and I'm sure the people listening have as well.
Thank you, Gary. Great being with you. Thanks for the conversation.
From Oslo, Norway, Professor Per Efsen Stoknes, and we are glad that he was with us talking about the issues of for why we deny climate change threats, even if we believe in global warming. Thank you for listening.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know